Good morning, everybody. It is hard to believe it is September and close to Labor Day with everything that's gone on since March. But time marches on, and, you know, we are where we are. So I hope everybody is staying safe and healthy. And as always, there's plenty to talk about this morning. The first thing I wanted to do is remind everybody, I know that I've spoken about this before in prior telebriefs, but in less than a month, that is on October the 1st of this year, there's a new Maryland law that will go into effect, which prohibits employers from requesting or relying on job applicants' prior pay history to make decisions about whether they're going to hire an applicant or in establishing initial pay for any particular applicant. This is a provision that is contained in Maryland's existing equal pay for equal work law. And again, what it does in many cases is restrict you as an employer from inquiring as you may have done in the past, or as one of your search firms or headhunting firms may have done, to ask directly an applicant what he or she was making. And it is a restriction. And it is similar to the laws in many other states, which have similar kinds of constraints on employers. It doesn't prohibit an applicant from voluntarily disclosing that, but you should remove that question in your Maryland employment applications. The other restriction or actually constraint on Maryland employers is that if a applicant asks what the wage range is for a particular job, you have to reveal that to that particular applicant. Some of you may not even have wage ranges. So obviously, as a takeaway in preparation for the implementation of this act on October 1st, you all ought to take a look at your job descriptions and your salaries, which are associated with any particular provision or any particular position, and establish a wage range if you don't already have one. So again, this act takes place on October the 1st, and you're going to have to make sure that if you utilize search firms or headhunters, that they know not to be asking on your behalf what the employee has made in prior salaries. So just a word to the wise, make sure that you comply with this in a matter of, you know, about 3 weeks. I was asked this week, as I've been asked many times during the pandemic, of whether or not an employer should have a waiver for its employees to sign, which would at least purportedly do away with any future liability associated with that employee getting COVID-19. The simple answer to this question is no, that these waivers are ineffective as a matter of public policy. It is, as most of you know, that in many cases, in most cases in Maryland and in many other states, the sole and exclusive remedy for an employee who is injured or obtains or sustains an occupational disease arising out of and in the course of his or her employment is workers' compensation. The exception to that would be where there is an intentional or deliberate act by the employer, which is precipitating a injury or occupational illness to the employee. The waivers simply are ineffective in this case, and I'm not talking about waivers that you might implement for visitors to your office or vendors, et cetera. That's a different story. But in terms of your employees, it's not a good idea. They're ineffective, and I would stay away from them. You can, however, certainly distribute and communicate those policies and procedures which you expect employees to follow as a result of the pandemic and get them to sign an acknowledgement that they understand those policies and procedures and will do their best to adhere to them. But that's different than requiring them to sign a waiver, which, as I've said, is ineffective usually and held by courts to be against public policy. Again, with the issue of the pandemic so ubiquitous in the workplace, on August the 24th, that was just a little more than a week ago, the Department of Labor and its wage and hour division promulgated guidance addressing your obligations as an employer to track employee hours for those people who are teleworking. And while this obviously would be applicable to the pandemic, it's also applicable even after the pandemic for any of those non-exempt employees who were remotely working. Now, I want to stress that this would only apply, of course, to the issue of what happens to those non-exempt employees who are working remotely. Your exempt employees, you certainly don't need to track hours because, as you know, irrespective of the number of hours that an exempt employee would be working, whether it's in your physical space or working remotely, they're paid the same salary, irrespective of the number of hours that they work. But for non-exempt employees, it's different. And as a result of this guidance, which you can find on the Department of Labor's website, you really need to figure out an effective way of tracking hours worked by your non-exempt employees, because you're going to be charged with paying these employees whether you have really authorized that time that is purportedly worked or not. Because under the Wage and Hour Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, employers are required to pay for any hours which are worked or suffered or permitted to be worked. So, a word to the wise, figure out the best way of tracking time. You may need to establish either a daily tracking system or a reporting system, or a weekly tracking or reporting system. But however you do it, you're going to have a system in place which enables you to track accurately the hours which are purportedly worked by your non-exempt employees. So again, I think that you can go on the Department of Labor's website, the Wage and Hour Division, read the guidance for yourself. But the bottom line is you're going to have to figure out a way to really understand and to be able to track accurately the hours that are worked by your non-exempt employees. Now, again, in a very recent guidance, and this was as soon or as recent as August the 27th, this was last Thursday, the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor put out a new edition of its frequently asked questions regarding the Families First Act as it pertains to school age children and whether or not your employees would be able to take leave or be protected under certain conditions, which are reflected in particular three frequently asked questions, which I'll review with you in a minute. So the Wage and Hour Division guidance states as follows, and this is from last Thursday. Again, easily accessible by you on the Department of Labor's website. So what the Department of Labor said was today, meaning last Thursday, the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division published new frequently asked questions for workers and employers about qualifying for paid leave under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act related to the reopening of schools. The guidance explains eligibility for paid leave relative to the varied formats and schedules schools have announced as they plan to reopen, including blending in-person with distance learning. Wage Hour Department offers this information to explain the benefits and protections available under both the paid sick leave and the expanded family and medical provisions of the Families First Act. They go on to say the Families First Act allows certain employees to take up to 2 weeks of paid sick leave and take up to 12 weeks of expanded family and medical leave, 10 of which are paid for specified reasons related to COVID-19. An eligible employee can take both types of paid leave because of a need to care for the employee's son or daughter whose school or place of care is closed or whose child care provider is unavailable due to COVID-19 related reasons. Since the department has received many requests for guidance on this topic, we believe publishing these frequently asked questions will help the public schools and employers clarify eligibility for this paid leave. Now I'm going to go over the particular questions that they circulated, which really have direct application to employers with school age children. So frequently asked question 98 is this. My child's school is operating on an alternate day or other hybrid attendance basis. The school is open each day, but students alternate between days attending school in person and days participating in remote learning. They are permitted to attend school only on their allotted in-person attendance days. May I take leave under the Families First Act in these circumstances? The answer by the Department of Labor is yes. You are eligible to take paid leave under the Families First Act on days when your child is not permitted to attend school in person and must instead engage in remote learning, as long as you need the leave to actually care for your child during that time, and only if no other suitable person is available to do so. For purposes of the Families First Act and its implementing regulations, the school is effectively, in quotes, closed, close quotes, to your child on days that he or she cannot attend in person. You may take paid leave under the Families First Act on each of your child's remote learning days. Number 99, that is frequently asked question 99. My child's school is giving me a choice between having my child attend in person or participate in a remote learning program for the fall. I signed up for the remote learning alternative because, for example, I worry that my child might contract COVID-19 and bring it home to the family. Since my child would be at home, may I take paid leave under the Families First Act in these circumstances? The answer by the Department of Labor is no. You are not eligible to take paid leave under the Families First Act because your child's school is not, in quotes, closed, close quotes, due to COVID-19 related reasons. It is open for your child to attend. Families First Leave is not available to take care of a child whose school is open for in-person attendance. If your child is home, not because his or her school is closed, but because you have chosen for the child to remain home, you are not entitled to Family First paid leave. However, if because of COVID-19, your child is under a quarantine order or has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-isolate or self-quarantine, you may be eligible to take paid leave to care for him or her. See frequently asked question 63. Also, as explained more fully in frequently asked question 98, if your child's school is operating on an alternative day or other hybrid attendance basis, you may be eligible to take paid leave under the Families First Act on each of your child's remote learning days because the school is effectively, in quotes, closed, close quotes, to your child on those days. Finally, frequently asked question 100. Again, this was from last week. My child's school is beginning the school year under a remote learning program out of concern for COVID-19, but has announced it will continue to evaluate local circumstances and make a decision about reopening for in-person attendance later in the school year. May I take paid leave under the Families First Act in these circumstances? Answer, yes. You are eligible to take paid leave under the Families First Act while your child's school remains closed. If your child's school reopens, the availability of paid leave under the Families First Act will depend on the particulars of the school's operations. So these were the frequently asked questions that were added, these three, by the Department of Labor last Thursday. But I think that in this pandemic age, it is a good resource to have all of these 100 frequently asked questions at your disposal, because the Department of Labor has done its best to provide guidance on many different situations under the Families First Act, the latest of which, again, were these three questions that were added last Thursday. The last thing that I wanted to mention this morning is that on August the 5th, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued guidance on employers facing issues of oxycodone, codeine, and other opioid use among its employees. And they issued this guidance as public policy. And while it's not necessarily binding, it certainly is persuasive as to how you will need to conduct yourself in the future with regard to employees or applicants who may have opioid issues. And by opioid, the EEOC defines them as codeine, morphine, oxycodone, Percodan, Percocet, hydrocodone, and meperidine, as well as illegal drugs like heroin. And these this guidance can be found easily on the EEOC's website. But I want to review certain of these because I don't know whether you have seen publication of these or gotten them since they're less than a month old at this point. So let me go over some of these. One, could I be automatically disqualified for a job because I use opioids or because I used opioids in the past? The EEOC answers, the ADA allows employers to fire you and take other employment actions against you based on illegal use of opioids, even if you do not have performance or safety problems. Also, employers are allowed to disqualify you if another federal law requires them to do it. For instance, those people that are covered under Department of Transportation restrictions on drug testing, etc. But if you aren't disqualified by federal law and your opioid use is legal, that is by prescription, an employer cannot automatically disqualify you because of opioid use without considering if there is a way for you to do the job safely and effectively. Two, what if I am in an MAT program? MAT program is a medication-assisted treatment program for opioid addiction that requires me to take opioid medication. Answer, if you are taking an opioid medication as directed in an MAT program, then you have a valid prescription and your use of the medication is legal. Under the ADA, you cannot be denied a job or fired from a job because you are in an MAT program unless you cannot do the job safely and effectively, or you are disqualified under another federal law. Three, what if a drug test comes back positive because I am lawfully using opioid medication? Answer, an employer should give anyone subject to drug testing an opportunity to provide information about lawful drug use that may cause a drug test result that allows or that shows opioid use. An employer may do this by asking before the test is administered whether you take medication that could cause a positive test result, or it may ask all people who test positive for an explanation. So those of you obviously out there who are doing drug testing, be aware again of this public policy guidance because you're going to have to take certain explanatory steps with the employee if it comes back positive for opioids. Performance and safety. This is number four by the EEOC. What if my employer thinks that my opioid use, history of opioid use, or treatment for opioid addiction could interfere with safe and effective job performance? This is an important one. Answer, if you aren't using opioids illegally, and aren't disqualified for the job by federal law, the employer may have to give you a reasonable accommodation before firing you or rejecting your job application based on opioid use. If the employer has let you know about this concern, then you need to ask for a reasonable accommodation if you want one. Then they define, of course, reasonable accommodation. But they have this caveat. However, an employer never has to lower production or performance standards, eliminate essential functions, that is, fundamental duties of a job, pay for work that is not performed, or excuse illegal drug use on the job as a reasonable accommodation. Question, this is number five by the EEOC. Could I get a reasonable accommodation because I take prescription opioids to treat pain? Answer, you may be able to get a reasonable accommodation if the medical condition that is causing pain qualifies as a disability under the ADA. A medical condition does not need to be permanent or stop you from working to be an ADA disability. Many conditions that cause pain significant enough for a doctor to prescribe opioids will qualify. Next question. Could I get a reasonable accommodation because... Hello?
Hey, Howard. We lost you there.
Not sure what's going on. Technical problems, I guess. Could you hear me saying unmute the phones, Casey?
Oh, no. No, I lost you completely. But we're all still hanging on for you.
Okay. All right. Well, I apologize. I don't know what happened. But as always, I appreciate everybody's participation. If anybody has a question, please let me know.
Patty. Hi, Howard. This is Patty. I have a question.
Yeah.
So I'm aware that the leave under FFCRA is available for intermittent leave.
That's right.
So it is. In the situation where an employee is allowed to telework, right, we deem that they can effectively do their job at home. We give them all the equipment necessary to do so. However, on certain days, based on how they need to support their children, they find they're not able to effectively do their job. They just don't have the time to focus on work that they have to support their kids. On those particular days, can they use the emergency sick leave? Can they get paid under that?
So you're saying that on the days when they really can't work,
right.
Even though there would be work that would be available, I don't believe under that circumstance they'd be entitled to the leave unless you voluntarily want to pay it and reduce their balance. But the question is really whether you'd be entitled to claim that payment as a tax credit. Because, you can claim tax credits for the leave that you pay.
Right.
So I don't think that it would qualify under that circumstance. Of course, if the employee had other leave available and wanted to use it and you allowed that employee to use it, I think that could be done. But technically, I don't think it qualifies for family first leave.
Okay. Even though their children's school is closed and they're doing virtual learning, and on that particular day, they need to take care of their children.
Well, but I thought what you were saying is that on that particular day, there's work for them to do, but they can't do it.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
They are they're at home taking care of their kids, but for the most part, they can do their job. But on some particular days, like, for example, this particular person has a stepchild, so she has more children sometimes than others, and then it gets more complicated. So on that particular day, she may not be able to do her work.
You know what, Patty? I don't think it qualifies, but I'll offline with you to make sure.
Okay.
Because I don't want to give you the wrong answer.
Sure, sure.
I mean, all this stuff has many nuances and tentacles to it. So let me check on that and offline, and I'll get back to you.
Okay. I have one more question.
Sure.
So our company has a policy under our COVID protocols that requires an employee with symptoms that are related to COVID to quarantine for 10 days per the CDC guidelines.
Right.
If that employee gets a COVID test and let's say 5 days in they find out they're negative, but our policy is 10-day quarantine regardless, can they use the emergency sick leave for the remaining 5 days to complete their 10 days of quarantine?
God, you're asking difficult questions, Patty.
And these are real situations. That's why I'm asking.
If he needs to get back to me,
I understand.
Yeah, if it's a matter of company policy, but it essentially, if the employee tests negative, I guess my basic question would be, why would you continue to need that employee to quarantine if the employee tests negative at that point?
I'm going to reach out to Connor on the pay lease thing.
I'm sorry, what?
That wasn't me. Somebody hasn't muted themselves. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
The reason that we require the full quarantine, one, because our board of directors has advised that because of the false negatives. We actually had an employee that took two tests. One was negative, one was positive, within one day of each other.
I see.
So, and we realized that depending on when you test, if you test too soon, you could get a negative even though you really are positive.
Right.
And we've had a couple of scenarios where we've confirmed that.
Right. Well, you know, certainly as a matter of company policy, you can do it. That's not the point. Your question is whether or not it qualifies for families first leave. You know, and therefore is compensable to the company if you pay it. Again, I'm going to have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
No, no worries.
You know.
I know it's complicated.
Yeah, it is. It really is. So any other questions? Any other questions that I can't answer?
Hey, Howard, this is Sandy. I want to go back to the EEOC.
Yeah.
Guidelines around opioid use
and drug
testing.
Sure.
So we just picked up a government contract where we do have to drug test those individuals. They're shuttle bus drivers for the government.
Right.
And so are you saying that we should be asking them prior to the drug testing if they're on any medications?
Well, first of all, Sandy, if your company has entered into a government contract, remember the EEOC's guidance is that these are general policy guidelines unless you're covered under a different federal law. My sense is that with your government contract, you are required to do this and that any positive would be a reason not to continue either hiring or retaining that employee.
Exactly.
So that these guidelines would not necessarily apply to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Well, at least
I
was able to answer one question. any other questions out there?
Howard, this is Anise Williams from PMCG. I wanted to know the same thing. The first question that was asked, that you're going to get back to us about. Is there any way that we can circulate some type of email, or should I email you directly to make sure that I'm included in those findings?
Well, yeah. So, Casey, you're on the phone, right?
Yeah.
So, I think it's a good question. Is there a way for me to just get an email circulated to everybody who's on this call?
Sure.
Okay. So, what I would do is I'll probably send an email answer to Casey, who obviously is in our firm and helps me on these calls, and then she can circulate it to everyone else on the call, if that's okay.
Thank you.
That's good.
Okay.
That's good.
Any other comments, questions? And you know what, Patty, if you're still on the phone, if you are.
I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's my request to you. Why don't you send me an email with those two questions?
Yeah.
And then I will send an answer to you with a copy to Casey, and she can forward it to everybody on the call.
Sure.
Okay?
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that'll be good.
All right, sounds good.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, listen, these are really crazy times. There are all kinds of questions that come up, and, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and I don't profess to have all the answers, as I've just indicated, at least off the top of my head. I appreciate everybody's participation. And in between these telebriefs, which occur on the first Wednesdays of every month, if you have a question that comes up, feel free to email me at hkerman@offitkerman.com. And I hope that everybody has a safe and enjoyable Labor Day, and we'll meet again, so to speak, on the first Wednesday in October, if not before. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.